Welcome, friends, to Why Should We Care About the Indo-Pacific? It's me, Ray Powell in California, former U.S. Air Force officer, all-around good guy. And that's Jim Caruso in New York, former diplomat, man about town. Jim, as we record this today, the Yankees are going to the World Series. Have you got your tickets?
I don't, but given that's New York versus California, you and I are going to have a lot to discuss in the future. James will explain this to you later.
Well, it's Southern California, and Northern Californians have mixed feelings about our friends to the South.
Well, New Yorkers have it all the same. It's all West. It really doesn't matter.
All right. Well, who have we got today?
Well, we're very fortunate today to be joined by James Crabtree, journalist, analyst, author, currently with the European Council of Foreign Relations as a fellow, writes a column for Foreign Policy Magazine, and something else he told me that I can't remember. He's a very busy man. He's also writing a new book. And if you've read his previous book, The Billionaire Raj, about India's economic activity in the past few years, it is a great read. James, so good to see you. I met you when you were heading up the International Institute for Strategic Studies in Singapore. Apparently you had so much fun, you're back in London.
That's right. Nice to see you, Jim. Nice to see you, Ray. Good to see two friends from my time in Singapore now that I have returned to rising Europe.
Yes, let's hope it keeps rising. Well, James, as we always begin these interviews, we're going to ask you our first question. Why should we all care about the apparent strategic ambiguity that India is following at the moment?
I think there's a danger of misreading what India's strategic direction has been over recent years. I mean, this is particularly true amongst Europeans, but in the West more generally, which is a function of what happened in the aftermath of the Ukraine war, which is that India had appeared to be growing closer to the West, the Quad countries, Japan, Australia, South Korea, United States, and Europe for a while. And then Ukraine happened, and many people expected that India would be helpful to Ukraine and the Western cause. And generally speaking, it wasn't. It wasn't too interested in doing anything to help Ukraine. It was very interested in buying cheap Russian gas. And that led to a perception that, in a sense, India had this ambiguous, omnidirectional, unprincipled foreign policy. And I think, particularly for your audience, that the danger is that that's just a misreading of what's going on in Delhi, where the most important change in Indian foreign policy is in reaction to the perceived threat of China. India has grown substantially closer to the United States, the Quad countries, and the Europeans over the last decade, but particularly over the last 5 years. And that's a very important change in India's strategic direction. China is the largest author of that change, as in it's China's behavior in the Himalayas and in the Indian Ocean that has threatened India and in a sense prompted this reaction. The countries of the West have, in a sense, seen a strategic opportunity to develop much closer ties with India and have been very pleased to take it because they have long sought that for all sorts of reasons that we can go into. And therefore, you know, I think it's just important to understand properly what's happening in India. India isn't going to throw Russia under the bus. It's going to keep buying cheap Russian oil for as long as it is available. It isn't going to do everything that the West wants it to do. It will, in many ways, continue to be a complicated partner, and it isn't going to send troops to help the United States if they get into a mess in Taiwan. But the relationship that India now has with the rest is totally different from you know, even when I was in India in the 2010s, and it's important, I think, to recognize the change in thinking that has happened in Delhi and their strategic priorities and the opportunities that that opens up.
Okay, so let's dig into that. So, you know, it used to be when we talked about India back during the Cold War, we would talk about it being non-aligned. And we had a recent conversation with Arzan Tarapur, where he preferred the word strategic autonomy to being non-aligned. You know, those of us who kind of wish it were either fish or fowl might describe this strategic promiscuity. But how would you describe how India sees its own foreign policy? You know, how is autonomy kind of the way that they would look at it?
Yeah, I mean, I mean, all states seek strategic autonomy, right? So it's one of these international relations kind of buzzwords, which doesn't mean anything in particular. I think it is true that India has, it doesn't have many, if any, alliance relationships of the sort that are familiar to American audiences, in the same way that China doesn't either. And it also seeks, as is true with many countries, to have a very broad selection of relationships. And that's partly a function of India's choice. It's also partly a function of a world in which there are simply more useful countries to be friends with. As in 10 or 15 years ago, it wasn't that important to be friends with the United Arab Emirates. And now it's very important to be friends with the United Arab Emirates because it's a very capable middle power and a useful partner to have whatever else you're doing in the Middle East. So yeah, I think strategic autonomy is a good way of thinking about it. I mean, I think your notion of strategic promiscuity, and not to pick you up on it, the fact that people use that kind of language speaks to a sort of frustration in the West, which is, you're meant to be on our side. We see the world in quite binary terms, and therefore, will you please do what we want you to do, which is either run down very substantially your relationship with Russia or do more to help us cope with China. India is a big independent country. It has its own, like France or South Korea, it has its own sense of its own national interest. And therefore, some of these things, there is a kind of reasonable overlap with the Western countries, the advanced industrial liberal democracies. And in some areas, there isn't. To take Russia as the most obvious example, viewed from Delhi, Russia is still a very important and useful strategic partner because of China. If India gets itself into a military conflict with China, it's going to need Russian weapons and repairs to its Russian platforms in order to prosecute that war. India is a very energy import dependent nation, and therefore having a partner like Russia that is willing to provide it with cheap energy resources is strategically very important. It's not like the United States, which is energy independent and therefore can make different choices. So I think that's the sort of strategic autonomy piece, is India has a growing role in the world and a sharper sense of its own national interest and, acts accordingly. But none of that is to kind of say that India is somehow, unreliable or unprincipled. Actually, the main principle of Indian foreign policy has become much clearer in recent years, which is that, like the United States, it sees itself as being in a security contest with China that is very threatening, and therefore the most important change in its orientation has been as a function of that. And, there are two things you can do as a country. You guys know this from the sort of your kind of international relations 101. You can either build up your own capability, internal balancing, so, grow your own economy, invest in your own military. India is trying to do that. It's not easy to do. And China has a big head start and has a much more capable military and a much bigger economy. The only other thing you can do is external balancing. You develop friendly relations with the other countries that are concerned about China's rise. And that's pretty much what you've seen India do over the last, 5, 10, even 20 years, if you go back to the Bush era in the early 2000s. So I think it is true that India can be, is an autonomous and increasingly muscular actor in international affairs, a country that is on a path almost certainly to becoming a global great power by, mid-century or roughly thereafter. And it can also be true to say that India is an increasingly important partner of the United States and the West.
So a manifestation of that presumably is the Quad, a range between Australia, Japan, India, and the U.S. But what is the Quad is not a security arrangement. What does it bring India in asserting their, not dominance, but their control over the Indian Ocean and their concerns about China?
In a funny way, the Quad has become a less important organizing principle of this new set of relations than perhaps one might have anticipated. As in, if one were to look at the most important, most dynamic examples of the trend that I'm talking about, then most of them would be bilateral, as in, you know, the US-India bilateral, the US-Japan bilateral, maybe the US-European Union bilateral to some lesser degree. The Quad, as you say, has its own sort of peculiar set of politics, which means that although the four countries involved are now sufficiently threatened by China that they are willing to act in a Quad format, they're not willing to act in a Quad format that includes very substantial hard security elements. And that's not always India's fault, actually. I mean, often it's Australia that has been the kind of the drag on that. Traditionally, people look at India and say India is the kind of the loose wheel in the Quad. And if only India was more willing to sort of poke the Chinese, then the Quad could be a kind of tougher, harder-edged grouping. But it's not always India who India's willingness to challenge China in certain circumstances has risen in recent years, as its own perception of the threat from China has also risen. So what does India get out of the Quad? That was your question. I mean, I think it provides it with international prestige. I think it provides it access to a platform in which China is not a member, and in which India is a very important participant. So for instance, if you look at India's other clubs, the BRICS, China is a member, the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, China is a member, the G20, China is a member. So, you know, so the Quad brings something unique to Indian diplomacy, and it's a useful messaging platform for not just for India, but for all of the participants. So I think India does get something out of it, but it isn't necessarily the sort of be all and end all of this new direction in Indian strategic foreign policy.
So let's talk about the security part of the Quad. And there would seem to me, and to many who look at it, that Malabar, the exercise that involves the Quad countries, which Australia asked for years to get into and is finally a part of, So the Quad countries are involved in Malabar, and yet nobody seems to want to call it a Quad exercise. Why is that?
So I think in part it is that the Quad as a body has been reoriented as a sort of public diplomacy platform, and therefore it is designed less to sort of push back against China in a hard sense and more to convince the non-aligned countries in the region that these four countries, the four sort of principal China opponents, as it were, they're not regional rabble-rousers, they're not troublemakers, they're not sort of stirring up trouble with the Chinese. So if you're sitting in Southeast Asia or the other countries of South Asia or the Pacific Islands, a lot of what the Quad is trying to do with its focus on what's called public goods, so, you know, the cancer moonshot that was unveiled at the last Quad Leaders Summit in the United States in September, or the vaccine initiative that happened during COVID, or HADR, or, you know, any of these things. In a sense, the principal audience of that are middle ground states in the Indo-Pacific who the leaders of the four Quad countries want to kind of prize away from China. They don't want them taking Belt and Road money. They want them looking to Delhi or Tokyo or Canberra or Washington. So if you then brand the Malabar exercise as a Quad exercise, it makes it more difficult to do that, because it makes it look like the Quad is in a sense a kind of wolf in sheep's clothing. It's really a security exercise, and all of this public good stuff is just padding. Now, there are plenty of people out there, and I would certainly have some sympathy with this view, who say that's a bit ridiculous. In a sense, the main issue that these countries face is the challenge of China, and you might as well deal with it head on, and kind of pretending that China doesn't exist and not mentioning China in your communiques is ultimately unhelpful. I mean, I suspect part of the reason why that happens is simply the internal dynamics between the four participants, which is the way the Quad seems to move forward is, so long as all four members are feeling similarly threatened by China at the same time, that opens up a space to do things together. But if there is a differential threat perception, then the grouping can only move as quickly as the least threatened member, if you see what I mean. So there's often some quite complicated politics between the four members.
All right, so the Quad is what it is. But the concern that India has about Chinese, whether it's territorial interests in along the border with India or the border with Chinese border with Nepal or Bhutan, is of great concern, as are Chinese activity in Pakistan and in the periphery of the Indian coast. But what is India actually therefore doing about these concerns? I guess that's why U.S. policymakers don't understand this strategic approach that India is taking.
Let me just before that, one other thought popped into my head about the Quad, which I know would be an area that Ray was interested in, I think you as well, Jim, which is the maritime domain awareness. So one of the things that happened at the last Quad Leaders Summit was there were a few initiatives to do with maritime domain awareness training. And a few years ago, the Quad countries launched a kind of maritime domain awareness technology system that all the Quad countries were going to roll out. It was called the Indo-Pacific Maritime Domain Awareness Initiative, I think. And when that was initially launched, it was they briefed out that this was, you know, very peaceable, and they got lots of partner nations in Southeast Asia, including Singapore and in the Pacific Islands. The idea was that this was going to help with stopping illegal fishing and piracy and climate change and that sort of thing. But when it was briefed out in the newspapers by officials from the US, it was given a much harder anti-China spin, as in, you know, this is going to help these countries counter malign activities from China. And that then created all sorts of havoc because all of the partner nations that the Quad had tried to sign up were comfortable with an initiative, the aim of which was to do sort of nice cuddly things, but they weren't comfortable with an initiative that came along with a whole bunch of kind of China bashing public narratives. And so that, I think, is the needle that the Quad countries collectively are trying to thread, that as there's a tension between the real thing that they're trying to do, which is they're trying to create a partnership which will help them balance China in the long run. But one of the mechanisms that they're trying to do that with is to build partnerships with other non-aligned countries to sort of thicken the network of countries that are either against or worried about, or at least not drifting towards China. And these things are in tension with one another. So I think that sometimes explains why, I'm sure, Ray, this is something in your work you've come across, that explains why the Quad acts the way that it does. I mean, very briefly, in terms of, I mean, I think India is doing lots of things in the areas that you talked about. So, you know, it's in the Himalayas, it is reinforcing its border, lots and lots of investments going into the Indian army in the Himalayas and the north in terms of sort of road building and moving equipment and manpower up to the north. In part, so much is going on that they're finding it difficult to fund some naval modernization in the Indian Ocean at the same time, as in, you know, they have two different challenges. In the north, you need army and air force, and in the Indian Ocean, you need navy and air force. And so they have two big investment priorities. So there is a process of military modernization going on, as with many other countries. You can make the case that maybe it's not far and fast enough. And then, you know, many of the other elements of the partnership with the US are designed to, you know, help India develop its military and security capabilities in the long term. For instance, through technology partnerships with the US and others, or defense industrial partnerships. So lying behind your question was a sort of supposition that India isn't doing enough, or in a sense is being too cautious about confronting China, and that may be fair. I'm not sure about that, but certainly there seem to be, if you speak to US officials, they tend to be quite pleased at the level of initiatives and the kind of initiatives that they're currently able to develop with Delhi, and the speed in which they're kind of brought to market, which is it's much less difficult to do than it would have been 10 or 15 years ago.
India has long had a policy, or that it calls ACT East, which is sort of toward ASEAN nations, the South China Sea. And even last year, it had a naval exercise with the ASEAN nations in which they went up into the South China Sea and even into the area that is encompassed by China's nine-dash line claim, which is pretty bold for ASEAN, and they may have been emboldened by the participation of India. So what is ACT East? Why does India have the policy? And I mean, is it a serious policy? Is it a priority for them? Or is it just sort of one in a list of things that they do with a certain bumper sticker?
So the ACT East policy was the successor to a previous policy known as Look East. It was an attempt to bulk up an Indian foreign policy that had traditionally looked west to Pakistan and what they call West Asia, so, you know, west towards the Middle East and Europe. I think it is a priority for India, but it isn't a top priority. If you look at the most important relationships which India has, its strategic relationships, then they're with the Western countries that I've talked about, and then a sort of smattering of other middle powers, Israel, the United Arab Emirates, maybe Singapore would sneak onto that list, and then Russia. So I don't think it's a top tier priority. I think there are contradictory impulses towards ASEAN and Southeast Asia in Delhi. On the one hand, India increasingly does see itself as having a strategic interest in the broad balance of power in Asia and East Asia, and therefore it is concerned about issues like what happens in Taiwan. But it doesn't see itself as having such a direct interest that it needs to put its finger on the scale itself. So, you know, India would not, for instance, be interested in doing freedom of navigation operations or doing many of the other things in the South China Sea that the Western countries are doing. Equally, I think there is a skepticism in India towards Southeast Asia now, which is a function of its own hardening approach to China. As in, if I put it extremely crudely, India views the Southeast Asian countries as, you know, really too close to China, unwilling to do anything that would annoy China. So it's a sort of ironic situation that there are some in the West that view India this way, as in, you know, India is too mindful of its relationship with China to do anything that is bold to help push back against China. India views the Southeast Asian countries the same way, and therefore is somewhat skeptical of what it is going to get out of security partnerships with these countries, and would prefer to develop security partnerships with countries that either have particular advanced capabilities like Israel, or that have those capabilities and have a much sort of tougher minded, clearer approach to China. That said, I think under Prime Minister Modi latterly, India is making more of an effort in terms of building security and economic partnerships in Southeast Asia. External Affairs Minister Jaishankar gave an interesting speech in Thailand about a year ago, you know, talking about how India could be a significant investor and an example and a partner in Southeast Asia. So I feel like it is an important second-tier priority for Modi's administration.
Well, you mentioned sort of the economic angle. As part of the decoupling, de-risking, whatever you want to call it, of Western companies from China, there's been a lot of foreign investment going into Southeast Asia as they seek to de-invest or invest outside of China. How much of that is going to India, given that's a huge internal market and highly developed technology sector? It seems like it's mostly going elsewhere. Why is that? And is Modi doing anything to adjust that?
I think a reasonable portion of it is going to India. So if I were to hold up in front of you, here we have one iPhone 15 Pro, which I bought when we relocated from Singapore to the United Kingdom. It's a made in India phone. Most of the components are probably still originally made in China, meaning it was assembled in India rather than predominantly made in India. But you are beginning to see Apple, Foxconn, you know, big global names involved in high-tech manufacturing relocating in India. And Apple has, you know, big aspirations over a period of years, maybe decades, to make India, you know, one of, if not the most important source of its foreign production, to recreate in India if not in whole, then in substantial part, the kind of technological ecosystem that it built in China. But, you know, India is starting from a long way back. So yes, you're right. You know, some of the de-risking, decoupling energy is going into Vietnam or Malaysia or Mexico or Poland. So it's not all kind of flooding into India in one go. And India is still a pretty difficult place to do business. It's not as hard as it used to be. So I think it's a mixed picture, but over the coming, you know, the coming decade, I think you'll see a very substantial investment in Indian production by Western companies. And that is partly for geopolitical reasons to do with production moving away from China or a China plus one strategy. And some of it simply a kind of India for India strategy that India remains a vast, fast growing market that most global multinationals, whether they're, you know, European, North American, Japanese, Korean, they need to have an India strategy in one form or another. So I think for all of those reasons, you know, India is going to be a much more important part of global value chains, as trade economists call them, in the future than it is today.
So what are the primary reasons that India is a difficult place to do business? Is it infrastructure? Is it corruption? Is it regulation? And then what is the government or can the government do about it?
No, all of the above. I mean, you know, it's an incredibly hard place to do business. Regulations are difficult. It's hard to hire people. Energy is expensive. The politics is complicated. So lots of companies have turned up in India and tried to do things and, you know, got themselves into all sorts of difficulties. The Modi government, to be fair, has, you know, tried to improve this. So, you know, it's easier to get government sort of permissions, they call it, you know, bits of paper that allow you to do things. Corruption, there are fewer grand corruption scandals than there were when I was a journalist in India in the 2010s. But in the end, to create the kind of large scale intensive manufacturing economy that can make cars or mobile phones, or in the world that your audience is more interested in, you know, that can be a defense exporter, then you need factor market reform, as in you need to be able to reform the way the labor market works to make it easier to hire and fire people. You need to be able to reform the land market so that you can, you know, get land for factories, energy, all of these kind of things. And progress there has been slower, simply because, you know, India is a very complicated country to run. And so the government has tried on a few occasions to reform some of these things. It simply hasn't been successful. It hasn't managed to do it in an effective way.
And does the protectionist instinct play a role as well? The few number of family-owned companies that seem to control a big chunk of the Indian economy, are they welcoming foreign investment, or are they trying to keep it out, or what?
I think it's a mixed picture. You know, some of these companies are quite happy to get into bed with foreign capital. So, you know, if you look at, I don't know, Starbucks, for instance, its main partnership was with India's Tata Group. Often when you're a foreign investor, then, you know, you do need to go in with a domestic incumbent. You know, it's helpful to do that. It defrays your risks. So you see that quite often. So I think, you know, India is still, you know, it, like the United States, increasingly has some protectionist instincts. Probably if you were to look at the data, there would be more protectionist measures. You know, on the other hand, India has signed a fair number of free trade agreements over the last few years, albeit with countries with whom it is geopolitically aligned. So it signed a kind of half trade agreement with Australia, it signed one with the UAE, it's negotiating one with the United Kingdom, which might get over the line. It's at least restarted one with the European Union, which has almost no hope of getting over the line. But the fact that they decided at least to start talking again was a symbol of the fact that because Europe and India are, in a sense, geopolitical partners, that they should be at least trying to do this. So India's trade orientation has always been somewhat protectionist, and that does make life difficult for foreign investors. But it's not a kind of total barrier in the way that it would have been before the reform era in the 1970s or the 1980s.
You mentioned before the BRICS. Can you, just for our audience, can you tell us what is the BRICS and what does India get out of it, if anything?
So on the day that we are speaking, this is the week of the BRICS summit. So the BRICS, originally it was a phrase coined by an analyst at Goldman Sachs. So it originally stood for Brazil, Russia, India, China. And then it was there was an S added to get to South Africa. So it's a five-nation emerging market grouping that was initially more of a kind of concept, but then over time it became an organization. It became a meeting that happened every year. And it has recently become much more geopolitically interesting because the BRICS grouping, at the behest of China, which is the largest and most powerful of the BRICS members and the one that has now sort of taken hold of the organization, has begun to expand. And so we now have a formulation called the BRICS Plus. And I actually am going to forget how many members it has, but they added, I think, six. And it's countries like the United Arab Emirates and Ethiopia, Argentina thought about joining. Indonesia has, I think, is now looking to join. Turkey. So in a sense, it's India, China, Russia, Brazil, South Africa, and then the kind of countries that are in the non-Western part of the G20. So sort of substantial global middle powers who are important players in their own region. The BRICS has become a much more kind of geopolitically interesting body. And there is a question as to whether or not the BRICS will become a kind of competitor to the G7. And or the G20, so the G7 being the grouping of Western industrial liberal democracies and the G20 being where the G7 meets the kind of global middle powers. At the moment, it hasn't played that role. It doesn't have a secretariat. It's not particularly well organized. It has a summit every now and again, but it hasn't done terribly much in terms of sort of initiatives. There was originally a BRICS investment bank, an international financial institution called the New Development Bank, but nothing very much has been heard from that. So there is some skepticism out there as to what this will amount to in practice. But for Russia and China, it's a very useful messaging opportunity. It allows them to have a summit every now and again in which they hit the West over the head and say the West is very hypocritical and, you know, this is the appropriate forum to show leadership for the global South. What does India get out of this? Well, it is another sort of globally established group that India is part of, so it has some prestige. I think it also would be very anxious if the BRICS was simply given over to China and China became the kind of overwhelming dominant sort of leader of the BRICS. So the fact that India is still in there means that India can keep an eye on what China is up to and act as a kind of balance. India also seeks to be a leader, if not the leader, of the global South. There was a pretty clear competition going on between China and India last year, where China was expanding the BRICS grouping and India was the chair of the G20 and put a lot of energy and effort into its own chairing of the G20. So I think India, it gets back to your point about sort of multi-alignment or an omnidirectional foreign policy. Generally speaking, being a member of these international groupings is helpful to, you know, most countries prefer to be in rather than out. They want to have a seat at the table. And that is how India looks at this. Interestingly, even as we're recording this, I see some news reporting that India and China have reached an agreement on patrolling the disagreed line of control in the Himalayas that was part of the source of the big disagreement between the two countries in 2020. This is known as the incident that happened in the Galwan Valley, where there was a military clash where some dozens of Indian and Chinese troops were killed. And since then, India and China have been struggling to find a way of, in a sense, going back to the status quo ante on the border and in so doing begin to kind of resurrect the rest of their relationship. It looks like some sort of deal has been struck. And the reason I mention this is that it is happening. It probably isn't an accident that this is being rolled out immediately before the BRICS summit, because then it may be that the Indian and Chinese leaders can meet at the BRICS summit, which would have been much more diplomatically difficult if they hadn't struck this. So it's not yet clear at the time that we're speaking how significant a deal this is, but the fact that there has been some kind of agreement on the border and it's happening in the week of the BRICS summit gives you a sense of the role, the sort of the cadence that these BRICS meetings can have. And the way that they provide, they can provide perhaps a forcing function to develop the relationships between the different members.
It's a good reminder for our American audience that diplomacy happens with or without us, which our next president might want to think about as well. Anyway, before you go, I wanted to ask you about the Shangri-La Dialogue, which you helped host through IISS for the past few years. Have you seen an increase in hostility or tension at these events? Is it a good forum for resolving any of those issues? Does there need to be another forum for these defense officials from around the world, or especially in Asia, to get together to try and resolve their differences?
Well, so yeah, I played a part in helping to organize the annual Shangri-La Dialogue, which happens in June in Singapore. It's run by the International Institute for Strategic Studies, and I used to be the executive director of the IISS office in Singapore in Asia. So I suppose I'm biased. I helped organize this event, and I see great value in this kind of track 1.5 defense diplomacy. If sort of lying behind your question is, have these events become somehow more combative because the geopolitical environment is becoming more difficult? I mean, maybe, but in the years that I did it, I wouldn't have said that was a particular issue. In a sense, you had the defense ministers of all of the kind of relevant regional countries coming, including China. And normally they would play the same role that they played in previous years. The US Defense Secretary would stand up and talk about allies and partners and the US's enduring role in the region. And the Chinese Defense Minister would stand up and say, the Americans are doing all sorts of terrible things and China is actually the true partner. And, it was sort of a fairly similar set of messages. I suppose it's not impossible to conceive of a time in the future where geopolitical relations in the region will have reached such a point that it is difficult for that kind of meeting to take place in the same way. But you could say that actually that's when these sort of meetings are needed most, that as relations in the region have deteriorated, then actually the value of meetings like the Shangri-La Dialogue in Singapore or the Raisina Dialogue in India, they've become proportionately more important because these sort of occasions for in-person diplomacy matter more. We saw that, there's a sort of test case during COVID where for a couple of years it wasn't possible to hold these meetings because, and I think people really felt the lack of them. It's very difficult to replace in-person diplomacy with meetings on Zoom calls, despite the great value of podcasts that are done over Zoom calls. In the end, if you're going to try and talk about difficult issues in defense or security, then people need to be in the same room. I tend to think that, that you might have looked at these big international meetings during COVID and said, well, they're going to be replaced by Zoom meetings or some other form of virtual diplomacy, but I saw no evidence that was the case, almost the opposite, that as the tensions in the region rose, then the need to meet in person simply got more pronounced.
All right. Well, James Crabtree, thank you for joining us. And before we let you go, we do want to give you a chance to tell people where they can find your work and what are you working on now?
Oh, all the usual places. I mean, I spend a little bit of time on the various social media platforms, probably mostly LinkedIn, but still X and various others. So I'm pretty easy to find. As I say, I'm in the early stages of writing a new book, which is about the strategic importance of the first island chain. which builds on some of the experiences that I had when I lived in Asia. And I'm doing a kind of smorgasbord of fun projects based in Europe with the European Council on Foreign Relations, also the Asia Society, which was the organization that Jim momentarily forgot in his kind introduction, yes. foreign policy, and others. So if any of your listeners pass through London, come look me up.
All right. Well, Jim sometimes forgets. He's getting a little older, and you know we have to remind him. So, thanks again for joining us, and we look forward to having you on sometime again in the future. Well, Jim, it's always fun to have Brits on the show. They approach things in their customary understated way. I was amused when he described the clash on the India-China border as a quote disagreement in which they beat each other over the head with clubs and sticks, and many people died. So it's very very British of him.
Well, it's better than the tiff, but yeah. he was very realistic about where India is in the world, how it sees itself, what our expectations should be of India as a strategic partner, which should be modest at all times, because they're a large, proud country with their own strategic interests, and they really don't like we Anglos telling them what they should be thinking.
Well, for sure. And who can blame them? Especially since, of course, there were some Anglos there for quite a long time from James' country, who they have a long history with.
The jewel and the crown.
So, actually, though, I thought it was really interesting as he talked about the Southeast Asian countries and India's frustration with them for, in essence, being too close to China. And it kind of puts into new relief some of their recent cooperation, for example, with the Philippines and providing them with things like BrahMos missiles and such. So, you know, it is a many faceted world, and again, defies our attempts to sort of put everything into two camps and divide everybody by color, if you will.
That's for sure. And India as a, well, whether it's a leader of the global South in fact or in its own mind, it is still a very important country in the global South. And it's important for the U.S. to keep on good terms with a leader like that.
When you talk about the BRICS or other groupings like that, in some ways, you know, having these countries that are not aligned with us formally, for example, through treaty or other, gives, you know, having good relations with them gives us levers into those places by, you know, we're not directly, of course, but we have an ability to sort of see into what's going on there through, you know, these outside countries, if you will. So, you know, obviously, and I think, you know, the other message there is the long-term trajectory of India is still in America's direction at present.
Right. They're still a democracy, largest democracy in the world, as is said frequently. Their economy is growing, although inequality is a real problem. And it is a counterweight, both economically and geostrategically, to China, despite the current apparent efforts to come to some sort of agreement on dealing with the border issues. They will most likely always be in competition. That's one sort of the other. So we need to play a smart game.
Yeah.
So Ray, speaking of smart, do you have a smart story for us today?
I don't know how smart it is. I thought since we were in South Asia today that I would go a little north of India and talk about my tour in Afghanistan, which took place back in 2012. And of course, as our audience is aware, I actually, you know, was in the military for 35 years, and so I had my time in the barrel and in both Iraq and Afghanistan. And so while I was in Afghanistan, we got, you know, pretty regularly, we would get shelled from somewhere up in the mountains. Of course, there are lots and lots of mountains. And I was on Bagram Air Base, which people might be familiar with. So it was a very large base. The things that were fired at us tended to be, they were not smart munitions, shall we say. They were rockets or artillery shells sort of pointed in our general direction with the hope that it might hit something. And usually it would hit in the middle of the field, and you know, occasionally somebody might be, you know, wounded or tragically killed. But for the most part, it was the kind of thing you just sort of put up with, right? And my job was I had to get up in the middle of the night when these things happened, which is usually, almost always in the middle of the night. And I had to go and take accountability and make sure that nobody was, you know, in our particular organization was amongst those unaccounted for or God forbid, killed or wounded. And so this, you know, so on the nights that we were shelled, they were long nights for me. Now, I worked for a guy who had been there for much longer than I had. And he had become very sort of ambivalent about his role in all of this drama. And he would announce to me every evening that he is going to bed. And if we are shelled, and he's going to bed and he's going to take an Ambien. And he did not expect to be awakened in the middle of the night. And unless the shell hit his hooch, he was not interested in being part of the accountability drill or any of the rest of these things. So I would call up to the command post and I would say, okay, we're 100% accounted for. And they would say, fine. But one night in the middle of the night, the people at the command post were new people and they were unsatisfied with my response. And they said, well, we want to know where the colonel was. I was lieutenant colonel at the time. So we want to know where the colonel is. And I said, I'm sure the colonel is asleep. And they said, well, we want to talk to him. And I said, I don't think you really want what you think you want. And they said, no, our checklist says we have to talk to him. And so eventually I said, look, it's your funeral. So they called me back later and they said, from now on, we'll talk to you. I said, yes.
You know, some people don't know when to take good advice.
No, it's, you know, he was an interesting fellow. In fact, one other quick little note on him. At one point he got a sergeant major and he was very excited about getting his own sergeant major because then he could send her out to do all kinds of sergeant majory things that, you know, the touchy feely stuff. He didn't like it at all. So when he got the sergeant major, he was very happy, but then she started doing sergeant majory things and he wasn't so crazy about it anymore. And because she would come back with feedback and all of the things that we should be doing differently. And that was not what he was interested in. He was more interested in her explaining to the people the grand strategic vision. He was not interested in that part where you get feedback. So I remember at one time, and by the way, she had a very definite idea of what her job was too. And she was trying to sort of move him off of that into accepting some of this feedback. And so I was sitting around this small table with myself and him and his deputy and the sergeant major. And she was going line by line through each thing that the troops had said that he should hear. And he would just, you know, lay into her after every single line. And she would just turn back in and go to the next line. And at a certain point, I got up and I said, I'm going to go to the latrine. And I never went back. And so later he found me and he said, hey, you never returned to my meeting. And I said, well, sir, I was going to. And then while I was outside the meeting room, I realized that I didn't want to. So I didn't. And he didn't know what to say about that. So he was an interesting fellow.
Well, thank goodness in the State Department, we never had that situation.
All right. Well, we've gone on a little long here, Jim. Our producer, of course, is Ian Ellis-Jones, who gets to deal with the technical difficulties that we had today. And hopefully our audience will not notice all of, besides James Crabtree's changing background, won't notice too much of that, of all of that, because he does great work. And he continues to churn out high quality military and geopolitical graphics on his site. So follow him on X at Ian Ellis-Jones. If you enjoyed us via an audio podcast, you might be interested in our video podcast, which you can find on youtube.com/IP podcast. And you can also find our other interviews, such as the aforementioned episode 25 with Arzan Tarapur, Why Should We Care If India Is Deprioritizing Its Navy? And of course, I wouldn't want to miss the opportunity to mention episode 16 with Atul Keshep, why should we care if India becomes the world's third largest economy, if only because it went so viral on YouTube that it became our top producing video podcast with over 30,000 views. So please also feel free to follow us on our social media pages on LinkedIn and X. And if you are watching us and you want to put us in your ears, instead, you can do the audio podcast on Apple, Spotify, Amazon, any of those things. Finally, for Jim and Ian, I'm Ray. Thanks for joining us on Why Should We Care About the Indo-Pacific?